Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. Senator Kubley, we don't have a quorum yet, so I think we'll start with a report from the Department of Health, and then we'll go back to you when we do get a quorum. So, Jim Golden, finally.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Record, my name is Jim Golden. I am the Division Director for the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. And one of the activities that we have there is the Center for Health Informatics, and we are responsible for the Minnesota eHealth Initiative that looks at health information technology. Madam Chair, committee members, in your packet is a handout, a presentation. It is the correct one, just to follow along, is the one that has February 22nd at the top. Madam Chair, I know that you had asked about the federal stimulus package. What I actually have in the presentation is both an update of the investments we have already made as a state, as well as how that positions us for the federal stimulus package. I think it does two things. It shows how we spent your money in the last biennium, as well as it shows how Minnesota is uniquely positioned to take advantage of the federal stimulus package. Looking at the second slide, you know, Minnesota has been really working on health information technology since 2004 with the initiation of the eHealth Initiative. Of course, we're not interested in health information technology for the sake of health information technology. We're really interested in looking at how it can improve the quality of healthcare, patient safety, reduce healthcare costs, and really enable individuals to participate more fully in their healthcare decisions. These goals are directly aligned with the federal stimulus package and will uniquely position us to be able to get as much of that money and to advance what we're doing. Just as a reminder of some of the activities that we have been pursuing from an objective, in 2008, we passed an initiative that required all providers, group purchasers, prescribers, people participating in the healthcare delivery system to begin doing e-prescribing by January of 2011. These are also requirements that are in the federal stimulus package for people that are using health information technology. Likewise, in 2007, the legislature passed a requirement that all healthcare providers and hospitals have an interoperable electronic health record by 2015, and that to help meet that the Department of Health, along with the eHealth Advisory Committee, start to put together a statewide plan on how we're going to meet that mandate. That statewide plan will be very beneficial. Much of the federal stimulus package requires states to have a statewide plan and requires that statewide plan be consistent with federal plans that will be developed. There was also a requirement that we start to develop uniform health data standards for the exchange of information by 2009. We have done a variety of work on that, which I'll talk a little bit later, but that is also a major focus of the federal stimulus package, particularly at the federal and national level. The final thing that we did is say that any monies that we give out and in meeting the requirements for having an interoperable EHR means that it has to be certified according to national standards to help try to make sure that we are able to exchange information. Moving on to the fourth slide, what you will see is basically the model that Minnesota has for adopting electronic health records. We really view the adoption of electronic health records as a three-phase type of activity. First, you have to adopt one. You have to actually buy one and start to implement it within your organization. Next, you have to utilize it or use it effectively to help deliver care. And then finally, you have to be able to use it to exchange. These are all components that are very consistent with the federal stimulus package, and it has been how we have been focusing our work thus far. Moving on to the fifth slide, between fiscal years 2006 and 2009, the legislature appropriated $14.6 million for a grant and loan program that targeted funds toward rural and safety net providers. Of those funds, $8.3 million were provided for grants, and $6.3 million were provided for loans. Both of these were very helpful, as you will see in a moment. Looking at the sixth page, just a little bit of information on the grants. There are two types of grants. We have planning grants that help people plan for how they're going to purchase and implement a system. We also have implementation grants that help people to actually implement the system. Within those grants, we had 29 planning grant requests. We were able to fund 25 of those. We had 64 requests for implementation grants, and we were able to fund 24 of those. In total, the amount of grant funds that were requested was approximately $27 million. We did fully fund 8.3 of that, but it still, as you can see, left a pretty significant hole and need within the state. Taking a look at where we spent some of our dollars, we really tried to target that towards safety net providers. Community clinics received about 43% of the planning grants and about 32% of the implementation grants. Fortunately, the planning grants were very helpful. Five organizations actually went from a planning grant and then received an implementation grant. A number of the organizations went on to do some of their own stuff, either fund it themselves or apply for federal funds or other funds in locations. I think one thing that's important to note is although we only funded 49 organizations through the grant program, the organizations, many of them were required to participate in a collaborative to think about how they would work together and how they would exchange information once they implemented these systems. This really allowed us to use the money and spread it over approximately 120 organizations. Taking a look at page 7, which is the map of Minnesota, shows generally how the funds were distributed around the state. We were able to do this on a very statewide basis and are very happy with the participation in all quarters of the state. One other note I would just like to point out, I guess, on some of the state stuff. In 2006, we provided Lock A Peril and their partners with a $40,000 planning grant. They were able to take that planning and use that in support of a grant from HRSA, and they were able to bring in $1.6 million in a critical access hospital health information technology grant. So this money has been able to be used to get other money and to be able to be used in a variety of productive ways such as that. I think one of the best things that came out of the 2007 session was really the EHR loan program. That really was helpful on a variety of fronts. First and foremost, it is probably one of the main mechanisms by which the federal stimulus package will actually use federal monies to help fund some of the capital expenditures within the stimulus package. We had $6.3 million to spend on this and to distribute in loans. We were able to set up a fully functioning loan program where providers, particularly safety net providers and rural providers, were able to apply for loans, be evaluated on the likelihood to pay it back, be evaluated that what they're purchasing and implementing is consistent with certified technology and leading toward exchange. The loan fund started out a little bit slow, but come about September or October of last year, demand shot up. I think other capital markets were a little bit harder to get some money through. In total, we had 27 requests for loans that totaled about $14.1 million. $3.4 million were found to be either ineligible or withdrawn because the participants chose not to ask for a loan. In total, we gave out $6.3 million in loans. You can see how it's divided between critical access hospitals, rural health clinics, as well as community clinics. We still had an unmet need of approximately $4.3 million.
And Mr. Golden, can you just remind us in regard to these loans, when they're repaid back, what the schedule is, and where the money goes once we get a payback on a loan?
Absolutely. The loans are a six-year loan. There is a grace period for the first 2 years of the program. So healthcare providers need to start paying the program back after 2 years and have it fully paid back within 6 years. It is an interest-free loan, and all of the funds go into a revolving loan fund for additional activity, loan activity. There's no other use of those monies.
And so is this a dedicated fund that they would be paying back that would be within the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay. And so we don't want to forget that this was health care access money.
I'm so noted.
And when the federal funds that are going to come to us get paid back, do you know how that would work?
In a loan program?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I will get to that
okay. In
a second. You know, one of the other things, looking what I have as slide 9, one of the other things that you asked us to do was to make sure that we had a statewide plan that addressed a number of issues. We have completed that plan. I believe we provided it to the committee. That really looked at focused on adoption. How are we going to get providers to adopt? How are we going to help them identify what some of the barriers are and some of the challenges? You know, certainly one of the challenges has always been financial. How can they afford it? But there's really a number of other challenges, such as know-how. Even if you can afford it, how do you start to buy an expensive system? How do you put it in place? And how do you start to use it quickly in the most cost-efficient manner? We also focused on a couple of areas that have some unique challenges, including long-term care and public health. This plan will serve us quite well. Almost all of the requirements in the federal stimulus package require the state to have a plan that focuses not only on adoption, but also how you will move from adoption to exchange and try to get effective use while doing all of that.
So, Mr. Golden, the fact that we actually have a plan that sort of fits in with the idea that the federal government has means that we would be able to get this money out into the communities much sooner?
Madam Chair, committee members, I think what it means is this. The federal government also put out a plan in June of last year. What the stimulus package requires them to do is to update that plan to be consistent with the stimulus package. I think what we will need to do is update our plan to make sure we're consistent with what that is and what the direction we've set. I don't know that it allows us to get it out more quickly. What I think it really does is it allows us to access more portions of the federal stimulus package because we are much better prepared to be able to do something like a loan. Very few states already have a revolving loan fund. All we need to do is make a couple of statutory changes, and our loan fund is ready to go. We've already done all of the analysis on how you would qualify a provider. We have thought quite a lot about technical assistance. That is another portion of the stimulus package. They would want to see how that ties into our plan. But again, it's an example of we've given a lot of thought to this, not only as the Department of Health, but really as an advisory committee that represents all of the stakeholders in the healthcare delivery system. And we've spoke with a unified voice for Minnesota. So I would say it's not quicker, but more complete and thorough. Madam Chair, committee members, looking at the slide that has standards reviewed, as you'll recall in 2007, that was a big concern of the legislature. Would we be able to get standards or would this become some kind of mess? And I think what we told you at the time is we wanted to make sure that we were in lockstep with the national efforts because we really wanted to make sure that vendors would have products that would support the standards that Minnesota used. We have done a number of things around that. We have reviewed how do you certify electronic health records to make sure that we're using stuff that's consistent. How do we start to look at medication management, which would include such things as medication history. How do we start to do the transmission of lab results in a standardized fashion? And how do we start to exchange immunization data? Looking at the slide that actually starts with, has a header of input to national standards, I think this is an example of where Minnesota has been unique and will be able to access federal stimulus money. One of the things that happened last fall is an organization that's responsible for standards and certification put out some national standards and certification documents. They went out in October. What we did is we gathered the stakeholders in Minnesota, the providers, the payers, and those with an interest in it. And through the eHealth Advisory Committee, we had a subcommittee that reviewed all of the standards. And when I say all of the standards, I really kind of mean all of the standards. there were over 1,400 standards in six areas: inpatient, ambulatory, emergency department, cardiovascular, and child health. We found that some of their standards were lacking. We pointed out 40 specific areas where we thought there should be some additional criteria that were put in there. And we had some concerns with 77 of the existing criteria, thinking that they may not serve the state well. The importance of this is really the last two lines. Minnesota was the only state that submitted a coordinated and combined statewide input. Minnesota was singled out by the national effort as being thanked for having a coordinated approach, and many of our comments were taken and taken much more seriously because it wasn't one organization or it wasn't state government. It was really a process that had all of the state of Minnesota signing on to describe what would be best overall for the state. The reason that I think this is important is one of the activities in the federal stimulus package that will be going on at the national level is they're going to greatly ramp up the standard setting effort. They're basically taking an organization that had a $63 million budget, providing them about a $2 billion budget, and one of their main activities is to move the standards ball along faster. Moving that along faster is going to require that Minnesota do this type of activity, do it as quickly as we did last time, but do it at a much higher level and a much more intensity. But at least we have experience in doing it, and I think we can continue to speak with one voice and have our voice heard much more so than any single organization would be able to. With that, Madam Chair.
So are there any questions on this part, which is basically what we've been doing up till now? Okay, I guess not.
Madam Chair, I will move into what is called the High-Tech Act. It's really the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act. You will probably hear a fair amount of numbers being tossed around with regard to what's actually there. I think the easiest way for us to describe it is there is approximately $31 billion that's being invested in health information technologies. And that's just through the High-Tech Act. There are actually some other funds that are also being invested in that. Looking at the second slide, let me help you understand how we get to the $31 billion. There's going to be $2 billion, which is appropriated to the Secretary of HHS for the Office of the National Coordinator. The Office of the National Coordinator needs to do a few things with that funding. First, they need to take $300 million of the $2 billion and distribute that to regional exchange efforts. You would expect that to go to organizations that are specifically working on health information exchange. In Minnesota, we have MNHI, which is a community collaborative, which the Department of Human Services is participating in. In the Duluth area, you have CHIC, and you have a number of other efforts around the state. Additionally, there is $20 million that is reserved for the National Institute on Standards and Technology. This will go for a variety of programs that I'll talk about later, but they would be responsible for primarily testing standards and a few other things. Well, the $2 billion is a lot of money, and we are well positioned to pull some of that money down to the state and use that. That's not where the real money in the bill is. Where the real money in health information technology is in the incentive payments that would flow through Medicare and Medicaid to providers and hospitals for their adoption and use of health information technology. You may start to hear some confusing numbers on this, so let me help explain how we get to our numbers. The Congress estimated that there will be $29 billion of incentive payments that flow through Medicare and Medicaid. These $29 billion will start in 2011 and will essentially end by 2019. There are also penalties that start in 2015 for any hospital or provider who has not started to adopt and use health information technologies according to the requirements. Because of these penalties, the CBO estimated that there would be a $12 billion offset in savings between the penalties and improved care. So I think what's important is you'll often see the net of $17 billion. While that's true that that's the net to the deficit, there's really $29 billion of incentive payments with $12 billion of offset through improved care and penalties. Additionally, although it's not on this page, I did want to just mention that there are some other funds that go to health information technology that are outside of the HITECH Act. There's $85 million that flows through the Department of the Interior for Indian Health Services for IT. There's $1.5 billion that will go to community health centers. That's not exclusively for health information technology. It's for capital expansion. But one of the allowed capital expansions is the adoption and implementation of health information technology, specifically electronic health records. And that would be grant money. There's also $500 million that goes to the Social Security Administration. $40 million of that can be used for health IT research, particularly on trying to connect to providers for disability claims. And then there's also $1.1 billion that goes to ARC, HHS, and National Institute for Health for comparative effectiveness research, which can include the use of health information technologies.
So, Mr. Golden, do we know if any of this money would be able to support the activities that the department has been carrying out in the past in Minnesota in terms of making and managing the loans?
Madam Chair, we do. That the department's activities would be eligible for a variety of programs under the $2 billion or $1.68 billion that's available, really, from the Office of the National Coordinator. So that would be support. For example, there's a grant program. It's a grant that comes into the state for state activities. There are also a variety of loan. We anticipate that there will be loan funds. There's certainly a program there, which I'll talk about. That would be coming out of the $2 billion. So there is, so I think really what we, the way to think about this is, the goal, I think, for the state is to figure out how to get as much of that $2 billion to support the activities that will help healthcare providers who are eligible for incentive payments bring down as much as they can of those incentive payments. We have some initial analysis on what we might be eligible for, but I would just suggest this. Of the $29 billion, if you take 2%, which is usually a halfway decent figure, that gets you to about $580 million in incentive payments. If you start to consider that Minnesota is farther ahead than many states in the implementation of health information technology, I would expect that Minnesota should be able to pull down more than the average. So really, I think what we're talking about is how do we get some of that $2 billion to really help us pull down somewhere between $600 to $800 million in incentive payments. I think that's really the objective that we should probably be focusing on collectively.
And Mr. Golden, is any of the money available for, you said that it would be available for loans to get the IT up and running with providers that maybe didn't get grant or loan funds from the state earlier?
Madam Chair, committee members, if you are patient, I will get to that in about three or four slides. What I'd like to just do, there are really two titles that are important within the bill. One is the activities that relate to the $2 billion, and then the other is related to the incentive payments. What I'd like to just do is start with the $2 billion. There are really four subtitles there. One is what's the Office of the National Coordinator responsible for? What is the National Institute of Standards and Technology responsible for? The topic of interest to you is grants and loan funding. And then there's a fourth subtitle, which is improved privacy and security provisions. Not really planning to talk about that. Don't anticipate that that will be a lot of effort for the state, nor is there really any fiscal impact at this point that we're noticing in that. And again, there is $2 billion for these subtitles. Starting with subtitle A, the Office of the National Coordinator, they really need to do, in this subtitle, a few things, and I think they're kind of important because we have to tie into them. First, they need to update their strategic plan. They published a strategic plan in June. Coincidentally, it was at almost the same time that we did. It matches ours very closely. Philosophically and concept-wise, it's almost identical. Differences would be in how we might term things. They're required to update that. We will also update ours to make sure that we are in lockstep with them and consistent with where they want to go and where the state wants to go. The other thing that they need to do is they need to establish an HIT policy committee. The HIT policy committee is really to provide policy direction and help the secretary and the Office of the National Coordinator figure out where they should prioritize their efforts in adoption exchange. How do you use these to improve patient care, reduce costs? How do you get patients more involved in their care through health information technologies, those types of activities? Not surprisingly, they also require that the Office of the National Coordinator establish an HIT standards committee. That committee is responsible for recommending standards, the implementation specifications to actually implement those standards, and then how those standards fit into certification criteria. This will be a tremendous amount of work at the national level. It'll also be a tremendous amount of work for Minnesota and the eHealth Advisory Committee, because we are going to want to make sure that we review those and that whatever standards are being proposed at the national level, that we really have our voice heard so that we can influence the standards on the front end and not have to wait until they're adopted and say, hey, these don't work real well for Minnesota, or they're going to cause all of our providers and our vendors to incur a lot of costs because it just doesn't work in how we deliver healthcare in Minnesota. Again, it's a task that we've done before. I think we just have to be prepared to do that, and doing it on the front end will ultimately save and make all of our jobs a lot easier, including the providers who need to ultimately implement these standards. Finally, the Office of the National Coordinator needs to name a privacy officer and support regional exchange with $300 million. Subtitle B is related to the National Institute for Standards and Technology. Not going to talk too much about that. Really, what they're responsible for is pilot testing some of the standards and specifications. They also work quite often with institutions of higher education. They have a grant program that they will be providing out to higher ed that looks at how do you use health information technologies to really integrate health information within and across institutions. And this is a great thing. It's much more of a research piece as opposed to an implementation. Hopefully what comes out of that will be able to help providers down the road. Moving on to Subtitle C, Grants and Loans Funding. I think this is obviously the subtitle that affects the state the most. What you can see on that slide is kind of what the goal as far as the Office of the National Coordinator is. They are responsible for investing in the infrastructure with whatever would be necessary to allow and promote the electronic exchange and use of health information technologies. One thing that they are required to do is the following. At the national level, they need to set up an HIT extension program that is really focused on technical assistance. This is really starting to get past the we need money to do this to we need some know-how to do this. We need to be able to get best practices and lessons learned into the hands of providers who are trying to implement this, and we need to do it quickly. Much of their job is to figure out what's the most effective way to implement this, how do we start to bring assistance in, how do we get participation, how do we use these things to actually accomplish our goal of getting better care. As part of developing a national HIT extension program, they are also required to contract with regional organizations to develop a regional HIT extension center. What a regional extension center is depends a little bit on the size of your region. In the New England states, you might imagine one center serving a variety of states. In a state like Texas, you might have two regional centers, one for East Texas and West Texas. In Minnesota, it wouldn't be unreasonable to think that we would have one regional HIT extension center. They have to be a nonprofit organization. This is an activity that Stratus Health has been performing in Minnesota as a QIO on a variety of things. It is one that we have supported through our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. I think one of the important things about the HIT extension centers is who they need to give assistance to. They need to prioritize their assistance first for nonprofit hospitals and critical access hospitals, second for FQHCs, third for entities in rural and underserved areas that serve the uninsured and underinsured, and then finally individual and small groups that focus on primary care. So again, the technical assistance at the federal level and through the regional groups are really focused on the safety net providers. I think what this means for Minnesota, it won't be the state government who is a regional extension center, but we'll want to make sure that the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, and the advisory committee are working closely with whoever our regional HIT extension center is to make sure that that HIT extension center is really being consistent with where we have been in the last 4 years in focusing on the goals of the state and the coordinated message.
And Mr. Golden, does the state designate that center, or do people apply directly to the federal government to get that designation?
We think that they will be able to apply directly, and it will be a competitive process. The other thing that needs to happen with that is, again, it has to be a nonprofit. They are also responsible for 50% of their funding. So it's anticipated that this organization, whomever it would probably charge some nominal amount for their services to cover the remaining 50%. The next activity are state grants to promote HIT. And just to be clear, these are not grants that the state gives out necessarily. They might be that, but what this really is these are grants to the states from the federal government to promote HIT. What the grant can be used for is to enhance the participation in exchange, identify resources to promote HIT, provide technical assistance, complement other grant programs, promote effective strategies to adopt and use HIT, assist patients in understanding how to utilize HIT, encourage physicians and clinics to work with the Extension Center, supporting local public health agencies, and promoting quality improvement, patient safety, cost reductions through the use of health IT. We anticipate that this is money that would come to the state, although it is not prohibited that this money could also go out from the state to providers or others in grants. I would be surprised if that is a large component of how the federal government sets this up. I think there are a variety of other mechanisms for getting grants out to the safety net providers and the like, so this is much more likely to be helping states coordinate their efforts, getting to the point you raised, Madam Chair, about is there an opportunity for federal funding to really help support the work that's been going on at the Department of Human Services, as well as at the advisory committee and their subcommittees. As you can see, this is a required program of the Secretary. They must provide these grants to the states. There are two types of grants, planning and implementation. Some states have not even really started on this. Minnesota has very far. We're much more likely to want an implementation grant. There is a state match that's required. In fiscal year 10, it's left up to the Secretary to determine whether or not this would be a grant program in fiscal year 10, and if so, what the match would be. In fiscal year 11, for each dollar of state funding, we can pull down $10 of federal funding, and then it starts to decrease in fiscal years 12 and 13 for a pull down of 7 and 3, respectively.
So, Mr. Golden, how much federal funds do we think would be available to Minnesota in this category?
Madam Chair, I don't know the—no one knows.
Well, how do they expect us to budget our state share then?
I don't know that they fully considered that. But I would say, what I would say is they put $1.68 billion into all of this particular these activities. Realistically, it would be difficult to imagine more than $1 billion going out to the states. But in looking how they need to distribute that, you have this grant program, you have the next one, which is the loan program. At this point, there's really no indication quite how they're going to distribute it. They have some activities that they need to do, including updating their plan, and then start to figure out how to put an application for states to do this. So that's what we know at this point. That's what they know at this point.
So when do we think we'll know more?
We would hope to know more within about 90 days. Beyond that, that's where HHS is at this point.
Do you think that any of the money will be available in 2010?
Madam Chair, I would anticipate that there will be money available in 2010. I would anticipate that there will be state grants in 2010. And as we'll see in the next slide, although it's optional, I would very much expect that there would be state loans available in 2010.
Well, 90 days is a pretty tough timeline for us in terms of our state budgeting target dates to know what the state would need to do to be able to match this money. I think it's pretty difficult to know how to respond to this.
Madam Chair, looking at the loan funds on the next page, these are grants to states to do a loan program. This is a loan program that is optional, although I would anticipate that it is going to be done. This is the primary vehicle by which the capital expenditures are financed within the bill. So the idea is that you have a pot of money which provides loans. This helps providers to be able to afford the capital expenditures necessary to implement EHRs and then really pull down their Medicare and Medicaid matches. There's a couple of interesting things about this. What it can be used for is to facilitate the purchase and use of a certified EHR. It does have to be a certified EHR or a qualified EHR, which is the same as a certified, except that it's not yet certified. Also training and then the exchange. There is a required state match of $1 of state funds for $5 of federal funds. The other thing that I think is good about this program is that the loan program cannot actually begin before January 1 of 2010. So states can't actually get money from the federal government before January 1 of 2010. And the reason is there are a number of requirements on the Office of the National Coordinator around standards, which are all due to be published by December 31st of 2009. So what they're really doing with the loan program is they're saying, we're going to wait until we pass the deadline for the standards that need to be done within the first 10 months of the bill to help ensure that any capital expenditures through a loan program are as consistent with where we want to go at a national level on standards as possible.
But still, we would have to appropriate money for this $1 for every $5.
Madam Chair, you are correct.
So do we have any idea how much federal funds might be available through this for the rest of the biennium?
We don't. I think we are looking at that right now. We are continually talking with Washington to try to understand what they're thinking. At this point, they're going through the bill. We're doing everything we can to get that, and I would anticipate that we would have something soon or sooner.
Sooner than 90 days?
We would hope that they would start to signal some of their direction.
Well, we would just request that when you know, you would get a memo to us.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions on this so far? Okay.
Madam Chair, moving rather quickly, there are a couple of other things that the money can be used for. There are grants that can be used by institutions of higher education to develop academic curricula. This is primarily for implementing HIT education into the clinical education of healthcare professionals. This is primarily a development grant, and it would go to higher ed to make sure that professionals are as able as possible to use HIT. There's also a grant that is required for HHS to put out that again goes to institutions of higher education to expand health informatics. These are really the people that help support these systems within an institution. And the bill is very clear in that it puts a priority on existing programs as well as programs that can start to put people into the workforce within 6 months. This will be helpful to make sure that the people are there to actually do the work, It also would provide some opportunities for some relocation for people who might be otherwise unemployed. Again, there is Subtitle D, which is on privacy and security. They made some changes to the HIPAA privacy regulations. There's some enhanced enforcement of HIPAA, including the ability for the AG to enforce various provisions in HIPAA. And then they took care of an issue that many people have been concerned about. The HIPAA privacy regulations actually do not apply to personal health records that are maintained by organizations that are not providers or health plans. Coming to mind might be someone like a Google or a Microsoft. This actually puts some provisions of HIPAA that apply to them, primarily around the areas of breach notification. That is the $2 billion. I will move quickly into the incentive payments. That was Title IV of the bill. What you see on the first slide are the Medicare incentive payments for professionals. And what professionals mean in this sense are non-hospital-based physicians. And what you see is they are eligible for incentive payments. It depends on what year they first start their use of an EHR. If they start in 2011 or 2012, they would be eligible for an $18,000 payment in year one, $12,000 in year two, and you can see the table from there. If they start in 2013, they're eligible initially for a $15,000 payment and then a $12,000, $8,000, et cetera. And if they start in 2014, the first payment is $12,000. If you're not implementing and using an EHR by 2014, you will receive no bonus payments. So that's why really the goal is to make sure that we get people using this quickly to be able to bring this money into the state. Another thing that I think is important is that for healthcare professionals, for physicians that practice in a health professional shortage area, they are eligible for a 10% bonus on top of these numbers. The other thing that I would point out is that there is a payment reduction to the physicians starting in 2015. So if physicians have not started to use an EHR in a meaningful way by 2015, their payments are reduced 1% in 2015, 2% in 2016, 3% in 2017, and it can continue up to 5%.
It's kind of nice how the timing fits with our dates.
Excuse me, Madam Chair?
I said it's kind of nice that their timing fits with our dates, since I don't think we actually really had any idea how we would implement our date anyway.
Fair enough. Perhaps what the second slide on the Medicare incentive for professionals, again, these are non-hospital-based physicians, shows really what the amount available is. Physicians that are using a qualified, which means a certified electronic health record, could receive up to $44,000 through Medicare if they're doing this by 2011 or 2012. Additionally, if you're in an HPSA, that 10% bonus would bring it up to $48,000. What's important about this is this applies to all physicians who use a certified EHR, regardless if they already have it or not. So
what percent of the state do we think will be ready to be able to claim these payments in 2011 through 2012?
Madam Chair, I don't have the answer to that question today. We are trying to do that analysis. What the number that we do have is we have a good sense on where primary care clinics are with regard to having an electronic health record. Our last analysis showed overall about 68% of primary care clinics actually have an electronic health record. It's in the low 70s in the metro area, in the about 58% in the rural area. And so we would anticipate that many of those are certified or on their way to being certified. I think what is going to be important is the next part of you need to be a meaningful user to get this. And so that means you need to have a certified product. That probably isn't the challenge. You have to demonstrate information exchange. And what that is you have to actually be using it to exchange information. The bill itself is a little bit vague on that, and I think it was intentional. I think it was intentional because they didn't want to put a standard that was so stringent that none of these incentive payments went out the door but at the same time, they didn't want to put a standard in the bill that was so loose that no one did exchange. I think what we're going to really have to see is how the Secretary of HHS clarifies what exactly the term demonstration information exchange means. And so it's a little bit hard to estimate, but we are starting to try to make some assumptions, and I think soon we'll have more detailed information. The other thing that I think you will be very interested in is that to be a meaningful user, you are also required to report clinical quality measures that would otherwise be required of CMS. So any type of measure that would be appropriate for your setting that is a voluntary program right now at CMS, in order to get these incentive payments, you must also submit those to CMS as well. So it will also really help to drive some of the quality reporting that is done and should really make sure that these EHRs are geared toward quality improvement. The next piece is the Medicare incentive payments for hospitals. The number that you will see tossed about is the first bullet. I repeat it because I think it is a kind of true statement. Hospitals can receive up to $16 million over 4 years. Well, let me just say that would be the absolute maximum if every last thing were the correct possible way. No one's going to probably ever receive $16 million. That's just reflecting that there's a wildly complicated formula figuring out their incentive payment. We have done some preliminary analysis using the data that we collect at the Department of Health. We believe that most hospitals in Minnesota, whether they are a critical access hospital or a PPS hospital, would probably be eligible for somewhere between $3 to $8 million per year. This is still well within the general costs of implementing a system. Most hospitals already have some type of system in place, so it's more likely that they would simply need to enhance their system as opposed to put in a new one. What you can start to see is some of the formula. There's an initial amount of $2 million. There's some formula for how many discharges. What I think is important about the Medicare share for hospitals is two things. One, the payment that you're eligible for is really based on a couple of things. A, how many discharges that you do. B, the Medicare share of your total volume. C, your charity care share of your total volume. And D, how quickly you do this because it starts to phase out over the 4 years. So the sooner you're up and running, the more Medicare and charity care you do, the more money you're going to be able to get. Also, Medicare payments are reduced for non-users beginning in 2015. Critical access hospitals are on a cost-based system that is consistent with this, but slightly more complicated. The final piece is the Medicaid incentive payment system. Medicaid incentive payment system differs a little bit from the Medicare. What this allows is Medicaid payments to certain providers. That class is broader than under Medicare, which was physicians, that have high Medicaid volumes. As you can see, it allows Medicaid to cover 85% of the provider's costs, and that coverage is matched by the federal government at 100%. There would be costs associating with administering the payments. Those costs are matched at 90%. It would leave the state responsible for covering 10% of the costs of administering the incentive program through the Medicaid program. One question is, who would be eligible for the Medicaid payments? What you can see is a list that is here. Any children's hospital would be eligible for Medicaid payments regardless of their Medicaid volume. Any acute care hospital that has at least 10% Medicaid patient volume would be eligible. Any professional who is working in a federally qualified health clinic or a rural health center that is seeing at least 30% of needy individuals. And needy individuals are defined as anyone that is in the Medicaid program, anyone who is uninsured, or anyone who is receiving services through a sliding fee scale, which would be a reasonable number of people in those settings. Additionally, any non-hospital-based professional with at least 30% Medicaid volume or any pediatrician with at least 20% volume. The hospital payments would be, again, based on the Medicaid share of their volume. So it, much like the Medicare share, it's proportional to the general amount of Medicaid patients that they are serving. With regard to the professionals that are in the other settings, the bill generally restricts it to their costs, but then caps it in the first year at $25,000 and $10,000 per year after that. So a clinic with two physicians would be eligible, for example, with $50,000 in the first year and then $20,000 in the next 3 years. And again, as with every other part of the bill, there are tremendous incentives for getting providers to start doing this sooner than later.
Thank you. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Golden, the three incentives, Medicare for professionals, physicians, that is, and Medicare for hospitals and Medicare and Medicaid incentive payments, they add up to $29 billion in incentives through 2015. And do we know what percentage each of the three different incentives would go to?
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, yes, the Congress in scoring this bill did estimate that the total incentives nationwide would be $29 billion. My suspicion is that they did divide that $29 billion among those three categories. I don't have that today. I could see if we might be able to get that information.
Other questions? Okay, well, we'll expect to hear from you more on this as time goes on here.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Thank you.
So let the record reflect that we have a quorum, and we will take up Senator Kubley's Senate File 328.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 328 seeks to form a stop-loss fund for a purchasing alliance. With me today is Greg Thorson, who's worked on this fairly extensively, and Chuck Ness, who has been associated with it. He's here primarily to answer questions, as I understand it, but I think to expedite your time, Madam Chair, I see you have a full agenda. I'll turn it over to Mr. Thorson and let him explain the bill.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for offering me the opportunity to share with you information about Senate File 328.
State your name.
My name is Greg Thorson. I'm a research coordinator for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. I serve as Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Minnesota Morris Campus from 1995 through 2008. My current position is as the Ken and Lynn Hall Endowed Chair of Public Policy at the University of Redlands. I received my PhD from the University of California at Riverside in 1995. I'm joined here today on my left by Chuck Ness, the Vice Chair for the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. Chuck has been on our board since its beginning in 2002. In addition to his duties with our purchasing alliance, Chuck serves as the CEO of the Minnesota Rural Health Cooperative, a large group of physicians, public agencies, and hospitals in West Central Minnesota. Our purchasing alliance is committed to working on solutions that benefit both the purchasers as well as the providers of healthcare services. My co-author, Professor Bart Finzel, could not be here due to an unavoidable conflict. Professor Finzel is the Distinguished Teaching Professor of Economics and Management at the University of Minnesota Morris. Professor Finzel has been with the University of Minnesota Morris since 1989, and he received his PhD from Cornell University. Please note that the views expressed here today represent the views of the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance. We are not here today representing the official views of either the University of Minnesota or the University of Redlands. Please first let me tell you a bit about our organization. The West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is a group of small business owners, healthcare providers, and insurance agents residing in the 12-county area of West Central Minnesota. All of the coverage of the various purchasing alliances are shown in Figure 1. And in your packet, You have a handout that looks like this on the front that indicates West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance on the title page. Figure one is found on page three. Unfortunately, the original was in color. Yours is in black and white. It's awfully hard to read. But I'll describe briefly what geographic region we represent. On the northern end, our purchasing alliance extends from Traverse, Grant, and Douglas counties to the north, to Yellow, Medicine, and Renville counties in the south. And in between, we have Big Stone, Stevens, Pope, Lockheed Parle, Chippewa, and Candy Eye counties. The mission of the West Central Healthcare Purchasing Alliance is to offer more affordable, high-quality health insurance options for small employers and residents in our region. We have held numerous public forums in the region and administered hundreds of surveys to our area businesses. We are registered as a purchasing alliance with the Minnesota Department of Health, as provided for by the Minnesota Community Purchasing Act that was passed by this legislature in 1997. The state of Minnesota is in a healthcare crisis, and the crisis is particularly acute among small business owners and their employees throughout the state of Minnesota. The high costs and limited access to health insurance is a major barrier to economic development throughout the state because it makes fostering entrepreneurship and creating small businesses much more difficult. In fact, one of the most important predictors of being uninsured is working for a small employer. Small employers are much less likely to offer health care insurance for their employees. And worse yet, the percentage of small businesses offering coverage has fallen in recent years. As you can see from figure two, which is on page four of your handout, in 2008, 99% of businesses with more than 200 employees offered health care insurance to their employees. In contrast, only 49% of businesses with fewer than 10 employees offered health care insurance to their employees. This problem is particularly acute in our region. In our 12-county area of West Central Minnesota, over 75% of our businesses have 9 or fewer employees. The full story is even worse for employees of small businesses. Employees of small businesses that are offered health insurance many times have coverage that pays for far less of their health care expenses, and as a result, must many times devote substantially more of their income to health care costs. Figure 3, which is found on page 5, shows that 35% of small employers offer these high-cost, high-deductible health insurance plans, in other words, that have less reimbursed costs from the insurer, while just 9% of large employers offer this type of coverage. The bill developed by our purchasing alliance and authored by Senator Kubley addresses the small employer health care insurance crisis by providing funding for stop-loss coverage for small employers with less than 50 employees who have not offered their employees health care coverage during the past 12 months. This state-subsidized stop-loss fund will cover all the individual health care expenses incurred by an individual in a calendar year that total between $30,000 and $100,000 in that calendar year. We'll partner with a fully insured partner who would be selected through a fair and open RFP process, and they would have a significant incentive then to work with us to provide insurance to our small employers. The liability of the fully insured partner would be limited then to only the first $30,000 per individual per calendar year and any amounts in excess of $100,000 per individual. The rest would be covered by this newly created state reinsurance fund. Our experience has been that in the absence of incentives, fully insured partners are reluctant to work with our region's small businesses. Many fully insured partners are less comfortable working with small businesses, and particularly to those small businesses that have not recently offered health care insurance to their employees. Many of them fear that there will be substantial health care expenditures during the first terms of offering coverage. A state-subsidized stop-loss fund would limit exposure for these fully insured partners and encourage the formation of partnerships between them and the various purchasing alliances in the state. It will also foster an environment where our fully insured partner can gain experience with products serving small employers. The ultimate goal is to create insurance products that will be affordable for entrepreneurs and small businesses to enable them to enhance their contribution to the economic revitalization of Minnesota. Please note, too, that state-subsidized stop-loss funds have been central to many state health care reforms, perhaps most notably in New York's Healthy New York program. We've done this before. In 2001, Minnesota established a nearly identical stop-loss fund to that proposed here, but it was repealed in 2007 due to the fact that it had not been used by the Purchasing Alliance as an operation at the time. Our proposal thus reenacts these statutes and extends the eligible time to 2014. The estimated cost for the bill to cover up to 2,500 people through 2014 is approximately $5.5 million. The funds would come from the dedicated resources in the Healthcare Access Fund. Given the time necessary to go through a competitive RFP process to launch the product, to enroll subscribers, expenditures in fiscal 2010 and 2011 would both be modest. A relatively small trial program would enable the Purchasing Alliance to move forward to product launch. If the program is successful, it could potentially result in significant cost savings to the state, as many of those who would enroll are now likely enrolled in Minnesota Care. Increasing or decreasing the appropriation for the stop-loss fund would increase or decrease the number of people we would be able to insure. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak about this exciting healthcare reform opportunity presented to you today, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Thorson, do we have any idea how many of the approximate 2,500 people that would be provided for through this bill would otherwise be eligible for Minnesota Care?
That's data that would be impossible at this point to it would be simply conjecture on my part to try and estimate that. We do know, as we've done these forums around the state, that many of the employees of small businesses in West Central Minnesota, if they don't have access to health care, are much more likely to be enrolled in Minnesota Care than in other regions of the state. But I don't have a specific percentage available.
Well, the reason I ask you the question, and it's a pretty important question, is because the Minnesota Care Fund currently is showing a deficit in 2013. So to provide money for this out of the Healthcare Access Fund, we really would have to show at least an offsetting savings, if not more than an offsetting savings.
And, Madam Chair, I guess what the Purchasing Alliance would request is essentially to think of this as a demonstration project to which we would get good data available from this relatively limited geographic region and size in which to initiate this process and get a sense of what the offsets would be after some actual experience data on Minnesota Care. When you look at overall patterns of enrollment in Minnesota Care, you do see them higher in rural areas, especially among lower employed, lower wage jobs in rural Minnesota among smaller businesses.
Are there other questions about this bill? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain why it was repealed in 2007, the stop-loss account?
It wasn't being used, and there was a need for savings. And so we took it. We took the savings.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Any other questions? Senator Lori.
I had a kind of similar question. Why wasn't it being used? I mean, why would we reinstitute it, and why wasn't it being used? Did it not work? Did it?
Mr. Thorson.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori. The purchasing alliances in the state have followed different paths. Some of them have tried to create accountable provider networks where it would allow for direct contracting between providers in an area and purchasers. Other have tried to directly purchase and partner with fully insured partners. None of the purchasing alliances at that time wanted to use this strategy. Our purchasing alliance now does want to. We want to partner with a fully insured partner of healthcare insurance licensed in the state of Minnesota to deliver healthcare insurance and to use the stop-loss fund this time.
Mr. Thorson, I guess another question would be if you have done an actuarial analysis to show, A, what the premium would be if the stop-loss coverage would be available, and B, how frequently and how much the stop-loss fund would be used, and as it's depleted, how it would be replenished.
Madam Chair, The information that I have is actually provided to me by Senator Kubley this morning. There are some estimates that the cost per member per year would begin at about $281 per enrollee in the first year of the program, with some assumptions that it would increase by 7% per year. I believe in your packets you have an analysis of the cost, potential cost of the bill under the fiscal note handout.
Well, Mr. Thorson, that's what's in the fiscal note, but it isn't clear to us how DHS arrived at these numbers that are in the fiscal note. I thought maybe you might have provided them to them, or some study that you had done might have provided the basis for the numbers.
Madam Chair, we have been operating as a group since 2002 and have funded our organization largely through small grants. We haven't been able to afford a lot of actuarial analysis. We have met with actuaries on two occasions in a formal setting. We haven't done a full actuarial analysis of the cost, but we have met with fully insured corporations in the state of Minnesota, fully insured companies in the state of Minnesota. And so the estimates were actually fairly similar to what we see in the DHS note as well.
Well, maybe there's someone from DHS that worked on the fiscal note then that could answer some questions about this.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name's Dave Green, and I work with the Department of Human Services. And we don't have a lot of experience working with these kinds of accounts. We largely relied on data from the Department of Health that they provided to us. They looked at some data on medical expenditure surveys and also on healthcare claims looked at the employment record or employment information, size of firms, things like that. And we were able to come up with about a $281 per member estimate.
Would someone from the Department of Health like to join Mr. Greenman at the table?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Sonier. I work for the Minnesota Department of Health, and we have been providing assistance to DHS on the fiscal note for this bill. We looked at a number of things, including the number of employers in the 12-county area that would be served by the Purchasing Alliance, used some information that we have on the percentage of employers not already offering coverage, needed to make some assumptions about how many employers would begin offering coverage as a result of this policy, because the reinsurance would only be available to employers who had not offered coverage in the previous year. We have some information on the number of employees per firm. The information on the percentage of people who are potentially enrolled in this program who would have claims over $30,000 in a given year, we used some information from the medical expenditure panel survey. So approximately 1.2% of the privately insured non-elderly population has claims over $30,000 in a given year. And sort of 0.1% of those actually exceed $100,000. So we did have some data available to us on how many people might exceed this threshold, what would be the average claims amount for people who exceeded the threshold that we used to put together these estimates.
And so you're estimating that no more than 30 people a year would qualify for the stop-loss claims. What would the average claim be in your estimate?
Madam Chair, the average claim for people who have claims between $30,000 and $100,000 is about $44,000 in a year. And if you are over that $100,000 threshold, the average claim for that group of people is about $137,000 in a year. The subsidy amounts for the $30,000 to $100,000 group would be 90% of the amount between $30,000 and $100,000, which works out to a subsidy of about $12,000 per person. And the subsidy for people with claims over $100,000 is capped at $63,000, which is 90% of $100,000 minus $30,000.
And Senator Kubley, then, does the bill just anticipate that the Health Care Access Fund would continually be replenishing this stop-loss pool?
You know, I don't know that, Madam Chair. Maybe Mr. Thorson.
Maybe we can pull another chair up to the table here and make room for one more.
Madam Chair, this is being presented to you as a type of demonstration project. It does have a sunset provision in it that expires January 1st, 2014.
Well, I guess my question is, if it was successful, would the idea be that we would continue to replenish the stop-loss fund from the Health Care Access Fund? I mean, if we don't think we're going to be successful, we shouldn't even be thinking about this. So,
our belief is that if the program is successful, and people who previously did not have access to employer-paid health care now suddenly take advantage of the new opportunity being offered by their employers, and the numbers projected. That it will have kind of a negative, it will have a negative effect on the expenditures for Minnesota care. So in terms of the overall costs, we should have some good cost impacts at the end of that demonstration project. I think there's not actuarial data to say with certainty that the offsets would be, the cost to the reinsurance would be greater than the reduction.
Whether there's an offset or not, that would be your plan, that we would just continue to replenish the losses from the stop-loss fund as they occurred from the Health Care Access Fund. Is that?
That is correct, that it would be a continuing relationship.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Kubley, for bringing this bill. I like the idea of the bill. It seems like one of the pieces that needs to be fixed in the system. But as we look at healthcare reform, it's really hard to change one cog in the system without affecting a lot of other cogs. And to Senator Berglund's point about the funding stream for this, after your deadline date, it's really going to impinge on the Healthcare Access Fund and other purposes that we use that money. And if we want to roll this out for the state, then we're going to have other sources of income from other savings areas. So it's like a puzzle when you put the whole thing together. Have you done any thought about long-term funding? Because you do want to use this as a pilot program, correct? And ideally expand it. So how would we continue to sustain the support to small businesses?
Madam Chair, Senator, uninsured people through their employer, we think in fairly significant numbers will be leaving Minnesota Care to take advantage of this employee-sponsored bill. So the net demands on the Health Care Access Fund would go down, not up. That's the idea of trying to let this demonstration project run its course. See in this region, small business owners who are not previously providing health care insurance to their employees that suddenly have this incentive to do so because the state's picking up a portion of that liability for each of their employees during a calendar year, will that entice them to now offer health insurance? And if they do, what percentage of those will be Minnesota Care and actually reduce then expenditures, reduce the draws out of the Health Care Access Fund? So it's a shift, but it's a net gain for the state, is what we think is a very strong chance of happening.
Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I am an individual in this part of the state, and I don't have insurance, as you're suggesting, and I do have Minnesota Care, and now through the creation of this, my employer is now offering some sort of package to me, what is the incentive for me as the individual? What's the incentive for me if I'm on Minnesota Care currently and my premiums presumably are, I would argue, quite affordable? as a practical measure, I think it's really good to I'm interested in having conversations about how we can enable small businesses in Minnesota to be able to offer insurance to their employees. I get that part, but as the individual, what's my incentive to turn over to my employer-based coverage now? I think
another way to ask the question is, if the premiums the first year are $281 per month per enrollee, I don't know what it would be for family coverage, but let's just say for that enrollee that the employer's going to pay half, because if they aren't paying half, it's not considered employer coverage. So they'd be paying, you know, $241 a month for a premium. Have you surveyed your members to see if they feel what that would be an affordable amount that they could make those kind of premium payments where they haven't been providing insurance in the past?
Madam Chair, the $281 estimate that was developed is actually the savings of an annual premium for a policy that's done. In other words, a policy that would be written without stop loss coverage would be X amount during a calendar year. It would be $281 less if the state offered this state-backed stop loss pool. Okay, so that's not an expected monthly cost to employees. That's how much the net savings would be.
Well, what would the premiums be then?
That's going to be another step in the process in terms of the products that will be developed in coordination with a fully insured partner that would be done for the sole benefit of selling them to people within the Purchasing Alliance region. Okay, and so those products may or may not look like existing products in the marketplace right now, because as we've seen from the data, the small employer market is less engaged in the process, and there are less products, some folks would argue, available to them that meet their needs and developed by them.
Well, if we don't even know how much the premiums are going to be, then we don't really know if this is going to work, do we?
The products will be developed jointly between the Healthcare Purchasing Alliance, which is made up of the small employers in the region, with a fully insured partner. There may be a range of products available, not simply a single product. But that product, what's different than from right now, is that it will be more affordable because of the presence of a state-backed stop-loss fund that will take some of the liability from that fully insured partner away. These folks are scared to do business with us. They see, look, these are small businesses who have previously not had health care insurance for their employees. We need to offer them something. We need to try to do something a little different, business as usual, of to say, will you work with small businesses in the region? The state will cover this $30,000 to $100,000 gap, and it may lessen the pressure then on MinnesotaCare, because more and more, as we see, as small businesses can't offer affordable insurance to their employees, that they're more and more going towards relying on MinnesotaCare. It's an opportunity to try and revitalize part of the broken piece of healthcare insurance in Minnesota nationally in terms of as it relates to small employers.
Well, I understand how the principle of stop-loss coverage can make insurance more affordable. It doesn't make it tons more affordable. It makes it a little more affordable. But if we don't even have an idea of how much the premiums are going to be, I'm not sure how we would go about evaluating whether this would be a wise expenditure of money or whether we'd just simply be creating another stop-loss fund that would go unused as it has in the past.
Madam Chair, before the problem was you didn't have a healthcare purchasing alliance that was interested or actively ready to use it. Well, now you do have one. Well, this product will be $281 cheaper per annum than what would be available in the market. This is also every model requires some difficult set of assumptions in the model. One of the problems right now, though, is that we would argue that these small businesses that aren't offering their insurance they're anticipating utilization data much worse than the aggregated amount of data that's being used by everyone in the system. They're anticipating that a whole bunch of people are going to come forward with nightmarish health histories to suddenly be buying health insurance in these small groups, and they're afraid of it. To get them the incentive to get back into the market of this, where we see the system is broken, where half of the small employers are not offering employer-sponsored health insurance, we need to offer them that to revitalize that market and to make the market actually work for them, that group as well.
Mr. Thorson, there was somebody that was asking for the previous stop-loss fund, telling us that they were going to use it. We didn't make it up and just put money in it. It was another organization similar to yours that indicated that they would be moving ahead.
Senator Berglund, it was AMOM, Advocates for Marketplace on Main Street, that pushed the bill, and Liz Quam had worked with Representative Huntley to develop that. This bill, by the way, did pass Representative Huntley's committee last year as well. So there was some interest on AMOM, but not the actual purchasing alliances. They wanted to have this as a tool available to the purchasing alliances at the time. None of the purchasing alliances took them up on it. AMOM was responsible for our creation as well. They're fantastic. They're looking for some new ways to address healthcare issues. And we're willing to do this. If you're willing to try this demonstration, we will engage it and carry it forward and do an RFP for fully insured partners and see if we can make this work. The investments, it's actually fairly small, too. As you can see, the different the first 2 years project actually in this analysis of around $370,000 in the next biennium. The potential for savings in Minnesota Care could be substantial if this becomes successful. And again, that's the nature of demonstration projects and healthcare in general. Healthcare has been an elusive solution, and we'd encourage you to give it a try.
Any further questions? Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Thorson. I appreciate that you have identified one very important sector of what's not working in the healthcare crisis, and that's small business. I think all of us come from, have a lot of small businesses in our area. And you're talking about revitalizing the marketplace sector, right? Because the insurance companies think it's too great a risk to cover the small businesses. And I'm looking at your map of the purchasing alliances, and my thought on this is that you're going about it in the wrong way as far as trying to cover these folks. What you're trying to attempt is the right end goal, but I think you're, in my opinion, you're going the wrong way around the mulberry bush. The health insurance company seems to be taking insurance premium dollars out of the system and getting in between the patient and the doctor, siphoning some of those dollars out that could be going to direct care. My question for you is, have you considered looking at these alliances and seeing if there's a way as an alliance that you could self-insure?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes. we've spent several years and a lot of money looking to self-insure. And that's actually a very significant story to tell. That's a long story to tell. Essentially, one of the co-ops tried to pursue that and had a great deal of difficulty with the Department of Commerce in making that work. And if you'd like me to share that story with you at some time. We were very interested in that because we believe that self-insuring can reap even more potential gains, but we were stopped dead in our tracks in that attempt to do that.
Madam Chair, Mr. Thorson.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
I think we need to keep pushing hard on that direction.
Any further questions? Senator Kubley, I believe we'll just lay this bill over for consideration later in the budgeting process. We appreciate you and your witnesses coming today, and we especially appreciate your patience with us as we got our meeting going today.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you.
The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 428.
Senate File 428, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the delete everything amendment, the A1 amendment.
Senator Berglund has moved the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A1 amendment has been adopted. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members, the purpose of this bill is to make it clear that the unallotment took place earlier in this fiscal year would be a shift. And there's a lot of additional language in this amendment that cleans up the Merck statute and has been recommended by the department if we were going to do this. It was never intended that the recommendation that I made to the governor for this be an unallotment in terms of a cut, but that it be a shift. And so I feel it's important early in the session here to make sure we get this language in front of us to clarify that.
Senator Berglund, in the handout with the fiscal note, and for members, there's three different components that are covered in this delete everything amendment that seek to address the concerns that have been noted. Any questions?
Right, and the fiscal note does, of course, show savings, which is the purpose of making the shift. It's to delay a payment in order to generate some savings.
Mr. Godfrey.
Madam Chair, members, I'd also just note that the bill also puts into place a cap, which is required by the recent waiver agreement that the state signed with CMS, to limit the amount of Merck payments to the fiscal year 09 level. And that's why on the fiscal note you'll see general fund savings in 11, 12, and 13. And that's the cap on the amount that is matched by the carve-out. And I believe it's around $52 million on an ongoing basis. So prior to that, it was based on what just overall MA spending was through the PMAP program.
Mr. Godfrey, on that, can you clarify for me, is that change as a result of new terms that were handed down from CMS, or was that from a negotiation between the department and CMS?
Madam Chair, members, I think maybe DHS could answer that better, but my understanding was that it was one of a number of provisions that the federal government wanted the state to agree to in order to renew the Minnesota Care waiver.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, maybe we could get the department to come to the table to answer a few questions about this for us.
So there's someone from the department that would be interested in coming forward. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Marie Zimmerman from the Department of Human Service.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
My question is whether...
it's a separate fund.
Let me preface my question by saying that this seems like a strange term of a waiver to me, especially in regard to the waiver that we were requesting. It was a waiver that we had been granted for over 15 years. Didn't seem like our waiver request had anything to do with Merck. And so it seemed like this was, we were sort of being held hostage in order to get the waiver. And so I'm wondering, in light of that, if we think there's any more room for negotiation on this cap with CMS, either now or in the future.
Ms. Zimmer.
Madam Chair and members, it's my understanding from our federal relations staff that this is something that CMS has had an issue with in the past, and that when we were renegotiating the waiver, there is a federal federal regulation that says you can't pay more in managed care than fee-for-service for medical education. And so CMS wanted us to do a comparison of managed care and fee-for-service, and since the populations have gotten so different, it was very hard to do, and there wasn't necessarily a methodology that we could agree on to do that. And also DHS thought that that comparison would be less favorable. So this agreed-upon limit we thought was that was negotiated with CMS was more favorable to the state.
So, Ms. Zimmer, I think in response to my earlier question, then, the answer is that this was a negotiation between CMS and the agency that's reflected in this.
Madam Chair, that Zimmer. Is correct.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, so how does CMS do this if you don't have any of your Medicaid population in fee-for-service? I mean, how do they figure out what you would be paying under fee-for-service for medical education?
Ms. Zimmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, you know, I'm not sure, and I have to admit I was not involved in the discussions about what the possible methodologies would be for comparison, so that's something that we would have to follow up with you on.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I would renew my question as to whether we believe that either now or in the future that CMS is open to discussing this further.
Ms. Zimmer.
I understand that the old administration had a longstanding concern about this. Do we feel that it is going to be a concern of the new administration as well?
Ms. Zimmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, you know, I don't want to speak for our federal relations staff, but I would assume that when the waiver is renegotiated renewal in 3 years, that things would be available to be renegotiated at that time.
Well, Senator Berglund.
I guess really my question is whether it would be possible to open up this issue prior to the renewal of the waiver, since this really didn't have anything to do with the waiver that we got.
Ms. Zimmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, if there are any, if a state law were to change or, I mean, I don't want to speak for our federal relations staff, but right now we've already agreed to the terms and conditions of the waiver. So as in terms of the waiver period, I don't know if there's any room to negotiate in the next 3 years, but that would be something that I would have to get back to with our assistant, our deputy Medicaid director, for her to respond to.
Ms. Zimmer, I would think that that would be a good conversation to have. And I think in light of the change, that it would behoove all of us to entertain that question sooner rather than later. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, it's my intention to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and I guess it would seem to me that if it's possible to reopen this issue, that we would want to put language in there to direct the department to do so as well. And I don't have that language available to do an amendment, and I don't know if it would be appropriate, but that would be my thinking on this.
Madam Chair, I think that would be a good idea. And perhaps we can... We'll move to lay this over, and during that time, we can develop some language to have ready if we move in that direction. Any further discussion from the committee? All right. Senator Berglund moves that Senate File 428 as amended be laid over. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Berglund, are you ready for your next bill?
The next bill is being tabled for today. Okay. The people can come, so the next thing would be the report.
All right. Senate File 694 is going to be laid on the table today, and we'll hear from the State Medical Review Team, Ann Quincy.
Senator Berglund, committee members, I want to thank you very much for the opportunity to present information to you today regarding the State Medical Review Team. I'm Ann Quincy, an attorney with the Legal Aid Society of Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. I have been representing low-income people with respect to their public benefits for approximately 20 years. And I've come to present information to you today and to seek your input as well about some problems that we've encountered with Minnesota's State Medical Review Team, the disability determination process specifically. Well, we're not seeking a legislative solution necessarily. We are seeking input from the legislature because we are not seeing the number of determinations of disability from the State Medical Review Team that we would expect. People who should be on medical assistance as disabled with shared costs, those costs shared with the federal government, are instead on general assistance medical care or Minnesota care, which you'll remember for single adults is still 100% paid for with state money. So I'd like to give you some context. My handout refers to the State Medical Review Team process for having people determined disabled. To be on medical assistance, to be eligible for medical assistance, you have to fit into an eligibility category, which I've cited here as set out in the statute. To be eligible, you have to be either a child under 21 receiving state or federal adoption assistance, a parent with dependent children, a pregnant woman, a disabled child, or aged, blind, or disabled. Aged is obviously as defined as 65 or older. Blind or disabled, however, has a statutory definition, which is a person who meets the categorical eligibility requirements of the Supplemental Security Income Program, or who would meet those requirements except for excess income or assets. So I've given you in my handout again the Social Security definition of disability, which is the overriding definition of disability we should be using in the SMART process. People who want to fit into the disabled category for MA either then get a certified or are certified as disabled either by Social Security in that disability determination process of Social Security or by the State Medical Review Team as required by the Medicaid regulation, which I've cited there. Frankly, if people that we saw were getting fairly swift, prompt decisions from Social Security when they apply for disability, we would probably not have noticed or be as concerned about the problems with the State Medical Review Team's determination of disability. But instead, what we see is that if you apply for Social Security disability in order to get the cash benefit, you are probably going to wait. The average time through all levels of appeal in Minnesota is more than 560 days. So it's more than a year and a half. 565 days is the current waiting time for a hearing, not including the current application, initial phase, or the reconsideration phase. I'm going to skip over my reference to the composition of the state medical review team to further give you context. I want to talk about how disability is to be determined by the state medical review team, and for that we need the five-step sequential evaluation. This is created by Social Security, and the chart which I've included is the process Social Security's developed through case law, regulations, Social Security policy statements, implementing that Social Security definition of disability. So we have the chart, and after considering the box which is not numbered one, which is just duration, after considering whether an impairment has lasted or is expected to last 12 months or result in death, we move to step one. Step one is very simple. It's, is the person engaged in substantial gainful activity? Substantial gainful activity is Social Security's definition of work. However, because the Minnesota statute says that we're not going to consider income and assets for people, the state medical review team skips step one. You aren't knocked out of the process if you are performing substantial gainful activity. And an example of that would be quite clearly someone who's applying for a disability determination so they can get MAEPD, Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities. So then we move to step two. Step two is, does the impairment significantly impair the ability to work? That is it severe? You'll notice I've put an asterisk next to step two. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Step three is, does the impairment meet or equal a listing? That is Social Security's list of per se disabilities. A diagnosis of certain stage cancers would meet a listing. A diagnosis of disability with an amputation of a limb would meet a listing. A diagnosis of a heart condition with the cardiology rating of a four, which means that the person has difficulty and is short of breath on one flight of stairs, would meet a listing. There's a huge set of regulations on the listings. Step four, however, once we get past step three, is does the claimant have the sufficient residual functional capacity, that is the physical exertional capacity, to go to their past work, again, a defined term. And step five is, could the claimant, if not able to return to their past work, do any work? I've put an asterisk next to the three steps, which, frankly, we believe are the source of the problems that we're seeing with the low numbers of determinations of disability. And by low number, I mean it's our belief that the numbers are lower now, the percentage of people determined disabled by the state medical review team, than they were in the past. The numbers that we have are from 2002, 2003, and 2004. There was a precipitous drop in 2004. We don't have the numbers past 2004, but anecdotally, we believe that people are still being determined or denied a determination of disability at a lower rate. The problems that we're seeing are in particular with step two, which is this a severe impairment? This is set out and defined by Social Security. So referring back to the Medicaid regulations, which says we'll determine disability according to the Social Security process, this is what binds the state medical review team, not a layperson's definition of is the condition severe. Social Security policy says, this was sort of hashed out in a U.S. Supreme Court decision by which the U.S. Supreme Court cited with approval Social Security's own ruling to set up a minimal threshold That is, we've determined the person is not working. At the second step, let's set a minimal threshold. This was set in back in the 80s when Social Security was inundated with applications and had no way to sort of sort out, was their opinion, sort out, there's absolutely no medical evidence here with, and the person isn't working, but we don't know why, with, okay, we should go on to the rest of the determination of disability because clearly there's at least a medical condition. Social Security's policy set out that this would be a minimal threshold where severe would mean the disability was more than a slight abnormality or a combination of slight abnormalities. Instead of applying this process or this standard at step two, what we have been seeing is that the state medical review team has been applying this standard and denying people as disabled who they say are completely unable to work. That's the standard they seem to be using. Or have been diagnosed with one or more complicated medical condition, but can still perform activities of daily living. That's not the standard. Through a data practices request, we asked for decisions by DHS fair hearing judges of SMRT denials in the past year. And I want to cite one to you. Again, names have been redacted. But the DHS fair hearing judge based the decision that this person was not disabled, would not be certified as disabled because their condition was not severe. The argument by the DHS person who sent in a memo to the judge stated that the person's condition would not be severe because although he had been diagnosed with diabetes, he had not lost a limb. Although he had a psychiatric disorder, which his licensed psychologist had assessed was major depressive disorder with poor stress tolerance, easily irritated, preoccupied with negative aspects of life, could only function in a quiet work environment with limited social interaction, the person's psychiatric disorder was not severe. And again, I point out that the severity standard here at step two, to even ask the question whether they meet the rest of the disability standard, is strictly, do they have more than a slight abnormality? The person alleging the allegations of disability were for the following conditions: post-neck surgery, hearing loss, mild to moderate, depression history, long-standing history of diabetes since age 5. We don't know, according to this decision, how old this person is. But someone comes and testifies at their hearing that they've known them for 55 years. So I'm guessing they're at least 55. Again, we think this is an example of how the process is sort of broken at step two and is diverting people away from the process of being certified as disabled too early in the process. However, I'm going to move on to steps 4 and 5. That decision that I've cited to you also doesn't say that the person meets a listing, so they didn't find them disabled at step 3, but they did no analysis at steps 4 and 5. And that's, again, a problem that we think we are seeing. Particularly, as I've set out in my handout, Social Security uses steps 4 and 5 to factor in things such as age, your past work history, and your educational level, because disability is not purely determined based on your medical condition. If you don't meet a listing, Social Security goes on to determine if your medical condition might be stopping you from doing work you previously did or work you know how to do, and at your age, which frankly starts at 50 for an adjustment to work ability dropping, at your age, whether you could adjust to other work in the economy. We are not seeing these kinds of determinations being done by the state medical review team, frankly, at all. Most decisions do not include the age of the individual whose disability is being determined. that we can see. Their work history is not included. Their education level is not included. And so, again, what we have is a gentleman who I'm guessing from, again, this same decision, is over 55. The conclusion is that the DHS fair hearing judge says that possibly this person could do sedentary work. There's no definition of sedentary work in the decision, but if that person were limited to sedentary work, in fact, Social Security would find them disabled. The DHS fair hearing judge, based on the memo from DHS in support of the SMRC decision, does not. The gentleman in this decision is waiting for a Social Security determination, and I suspect he'll be found disabled by Social Security. But in the meantime, he has psychiatric care, ongoing chronic care for his chronic diabetes. He may end up in the hospital. And all of that care is being paid for either, I believe, by GAMC in this case, because there's no evidence that he's working and on Minnesota Care. Finally, just another highlight of why this is a serious cost issue to the state. If people are not properly slotted into the categories of eligibility for MA and therefore are not receiving medical assistance, I have an example of a client of mine who the state medical review team actually denied doing a disability determination because the gentleman was in the hospital and had already been slated to enter a GAMC HMO. Because they'd already processed some of the paperwork for placing this man on an HMO on GAMC, they were not going to pay, they were not going to do the state, the determination of disability. He'd previously been on SSI for 18 years. He had a serious decompensation, ended up off his medication at the time that Social Security was doing a routine disability review. So his benefits stopped. So he fell off medical assistance and ended up on GAMC. And because the SMRT said that they could not process a disability determination for him, he couldn't get medical assistance, which meant that his commitment order, which required supervised administration of his psychiatric medication before he could leave the hospital, couldn't be implemented. He couldn't leave the hospital. And under my calculation, he spent at least an extra 2 to 3 weeks in the secure psychiatric ward at HCMC, paid for by general assistance medical care, before we successfully got him back on SSI about a month later after he'd left the hospital. I would point out that the department, the agency, does have staff that it's called revenue enhancement, and they do have staff to make sure that people who have been on GAMC and then moved to SSI and medical assistance that comes with it, that those bills are submitted for the federal match for medical assistance in the for the period that the person gets on. But it would have helped a lot if he could have left the hospital with some hospital home health ability to administer his medication, and it probably would have meant he could have left the hospital a lot sooner.
Are there questions? I'd like to know if there's someone from the department here to comment on this process.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. And I get this, this is the first, I know Ann and I have discussed some issues in the past. However, this is the first that I have heard of her concerns most recently. I guess we do know that there are concerns about the SMRT process, but as far as what the department does, we do the disability review. We rely on the counties to gather the information, the medical information, send it into us. Then we do the disability review. I can't comment on the specific instances that Ann has brought up. We can check into those, but we generally skip to step three when we do a disability review. We assume that people coming to us through the SMRT process do have a severe condition or a number of conditions, and go to the listing and then look at step four and step five. So we have added step four and five in the past 3 years or so. We have gotten Ann's request for the numbers, and we're working on that. We have gone from approximately 3,000 applications 4 or 5 years ago to we are now receiving about 7,000 applications through the SMRT process on an annual basis. And the numbers that we are looking at that as far as the numbers that we deny, my thought is that the numbers that we have denied haven't changed much, but we'll get those specifics for her. But we probably approve about 90 to 95% of the people who apply through the SMRT process are approved as disabled and then are put onto medical assistance. So I guess what I can say is that we we'll review our numbers and take a look at our process. I think that there are some things that we can change to help that process move along. But the reviewers, before a case is denied, is reviewed by a physician or a mental health professional who does have background in Social Security disability guidelines, because those are the guidelines that we must use. Social Security guidelines is a fairly high bar to meet a total disability determination, but those are reviewed by physicians and mental health professionals that are familiar with that process.
So what is your processing time on average for an application?
Once the Department of Human Services gets all the information that we need to make a determination, we can make a determination within 2 to 3 weeks. The unfortunate thing, though, is that about half the time, the information that we get from the county is not complete. So about half the time, we have to go back to the county and ask for further information from them. But once we get everything into the file, we can make a determination within 2 to 3 weeks. But what happens, unfortunately, is that sometimes a person has to go to the county, see if they're eligible for any other way door onto MA. So really, the SMRT process is the last door onto MA. So it takes some time for the county to determine that. Then the person needs to go and gather the medical information themselves, bring it back to the county, and then the county sends it to us. So there's a period of time there that all this information is gathered by the person and brought to the county. Once the county sends it in to us, we look at that for completeness. And like I said, unfortunately, about half the time, we have to go back to the county and tell them we don't have all the information that we need. Once we do have it, though, it's made within about 2 or 3 weeks.
So I don't understand. The ways you get onto medical assistance are you're elderly, meaning you're 65 years of age or over, or you have minor children in your care. The only other way you get on is if you've been determined disabled. So why would it take the county a long time to figure out whether you have minor children or whether you're 65 or over?
Madam Chair, I believe probably the time frame may be more attached to the process of having the person to go and get their medical records and bring them back to the county.
And why would the county need to be doing that piece? I mean, it doesn't seem to me right now in the middle of this conversation that it's particularly in the state's interest to have the county be doing that piece, since otherwise these people are on general assistance medical care or Minnesota care. And the county isn't paying anything for them to be on those programs.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how many people are on programs already. There are a number of people who come through the SMRT process who aren't on any program.
Well, but there are a number of them that probably are on a program that shouldn't be. It should be on a different program, is what I'm concluding from this conversation. I'll give you an example. The young man who testified last week about possibly losing Minnesota care because he can't lift more than 10 pounds and he can't work more than 10 hours a week. Does he sound like a candidate for disability to you? I mean, I think there's two parts to the problem here. One is a problem of timeliness of applications for people who are applying. I think the other side of the problem is people who may not be applying who should be applying.
And Madam Chair, I would point out that our numbers from the county that we do have access to, the numbers that we did have access to being Hennepin County's numbers, are slightly lower than, are quite a bit lower than what Ms. Reisdorf mentioned. They say that in 2008, their determination of disability for single adults was at about 70%. They do point out, as Ms. Reisdorf does, that in a large number of cases, the information, it takes a long time to get the information. It does have to go from the county or from the doctor, usually through the patient, back to the county. The county then sends it on to the state medical review team. The county workers, as you can imagine, are already dealing with welfare payments or you know, cash assistance, healthcare assistance, food assistance, emergency assistance. It's that same worker who's supposed to help you gather your information for the state medical review team.
So I'm just asking, Ms. Reisdorf, would there be any harm in skipping the middle step there of having the records turned over to the county and instead having them turned over directly to the state?
Madam Chair, I think that there are some advantages to having that step out of the way. I think the first thing, though, is that we need to make sure that they're not eligible for any other program. And we can get the numbers of people who come through the SMRT process who aren't on any program to start out with. But I think that that's one thing that we are looking at is to find ways to speed up that process. I think electronic medical records is one thing that was discussed earlier that will help with that, so that we can gather information electronically. But I think that is something that we can certainly look into and are really looking into right now, is trying to speed up that process, because, like I said, once we get the information, it's a fairly speedy response. But trying to help the person gather the information and have them come maybe to one spot and have one, either whether it's DHS or some other contracted entity, help with that, I think would help the process. There would be some, you know, additional FTEs that we would have to have in order to do that. But I think that having 87 counties struggle with this process is something that we know is, you know, hinders the process and lengthens the time that the person has to wait for a determination.
Are there other questions? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Quincy. And I think we'll be having our staff be in contact with you, because I think this is something that, whether you feel like we need to follow up on it or not, I feel like we need to follow up on it.
Thank
I mean, this
much.
Is a group of people that the governor has said we can't afford anymore. So if we can't afford them anymore, my goodness, how many of them would otherwise be eligible to be on Medicaid? Let's move on then. We were going to get an update from Senator Lynch about the mandates working group.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been working with Senator Lori, Senator Sharon, and Senator Rosen. We anticipate that our bill will be introduced yet this week. And there are, it looks like, 6 provisions in the bill that fall under human services and 10 that will fall under the topic of health care. Having said that, it's been a rather interesting process along the way, and as a result, there will be a corrections flexibility bill that's coming forward and an education flexibility bill that is coming forward, and a couple of provisions have been directed to some other divisions, not necessarily in the form of legislation, but in some ideas that ended up in our work group for one reason or another that we felt were worthy of passing along. So I think that was a good thing in the process. There were a number of provisions that came to us that you will not see in the legislation, and those were weeded out primarily if they were we tried to, as much as we could, weed out provisions that had fiscal cost associated with them. I guess we'll see how successful we were in that endeavor soon. But there was a concerted effort to do that. We tried to weed out things that, frankly, had federal stipulations and ties to them that perhaps need to be addressed, some of which were brought forward today, but in a different mechanism. And frankly, some of the things that were brought forward were of a nature that required much more discussion. I'm thinking of, for example, in this area of special transportation. So there were some hot button areas that I think you're going to see some things moving forward under different bills. And Madam Chair, if you'd like, I can go through very briefly the six provisions in the Human Services article and the 10 in the healthcare article, if that would be of interest.
I think we'll wait until you have your bill introduced to do that. I just thought for members of the committee that haven't been serving on this subcommittee, that we'd get kind of a general update so they would know what to be expecting. But there aren't very many of us here right now, so... so I guess we'll probably wait until you get the bill introduced, and then we'll be not only going through the provisions, but we'll have the actual language in front of us.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just one other final comment, and I know of particular interest to you. There is, I guess, the downside for the division is that I don't expect that this bill is going to create significant savings to the division, significant savings to the state. But what I do think is that there are opportunities, and I hope measurable opportunities, afforded in this for counties and for some of the interest in stakeholder groups out there. And in part, I think as much as anything, that was our intention and our desire was to afford some flexibility. And I think you're going to see that.
Well, and Senator Lynch, of course, if there were savings to the state, then those items would need to be held over for the budget bill. So presumably if there are other provisions that can move forward that would give relief to the counties, those could move forward without needing to wait for a budget bill. Okay, any questions? If not, thank you very much. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.